Hello and welcome to the Racing with Rob and Roller podcast. My name is Rob Peters in Indianapolis, and I am joined, as always, by my good friend and co-host, Josh Roller, located in Charlotte, North Carolina. We had a nice little preview of what we call Racemas over the weekend, in which F1, IndyCar, and NASCAR are all in action during the same weekend. Hey, bonus points if you're me. The Supercars was also in action. That was always rad. But hey, the Chinese Grand Prix returned for the first time since 2019. And then Scott Dixon demonstrated why he's quite literally the greatest by stretching his fuel longer than anyone, even his team, expected. And then, hey, Supercars was returning to New Zealand at Taupo, which now I know how to pronounce. I am now aware that that is how it is pronounced. It is pronounced Taupo. I have learned that. I apologize to all the Kiwis who wanted to just probably strangle me and say, you bloody Yank, what are you doing? I have amended that problem. But anyway, moving on, we'll talk about Taupo, I promise. In NASCAR, we had a quote-unquote relatively calm Talladega race, at least on the Cup side. Can't necessarily say that much for the Xfinity side, but I would say that the Cup race should go down as a classic. And let me tell you something, there's just so much to get into today. So we'll go ahead and jump right on into the news. We'll start off with Rob's racing report. I promise you'll hear Josh's voice here in a little bit. But we'll start off with Formula One news. Circuit of the Americas is offering to buy back general admission Formula One tickets purchased during a quote-unquote early bird special for more than face value as the track prepares to announce its music acts. All right. Moving on. Mario Andretti told the Associated Press over the weekend that he was quote-unquote offended by comments made by Formula One regarding their belief that Andretti Global would not be competitive, as well as quote-unquote disrespect over the team's proposed GM partnership. More on this later in the show here, this next piece of news. The F1 Commission is set to discuss a restructuring of the Formula One point system that would see a top 12 be awarded points instead of the current 10 during a Formula One Grand Prix. I think you all know my opinion on that, but we will save it for later on in the show because we have some IndyCar news to talk about first. Fresh off an 11th place finish on debut, Teo Pulcher will return to the McLaren number 6 coming up at Barber. But now, kind of bigger news for that. It looks like Nathan Brown of the Indy Star has reported that David Malukas' injury has not progressed as quickly as initially hoped. Pulcher will be available to run at least the Indy Grand Prix if necessary. Callum Ilott would stand in for the Indy 500, at least according to Nathan Brown. Now, also in that article, Brown talks about how Malukas' contract is essentially structured as, despite the fact that McLaren said it was a multi-year deal, appears to be a one-year deal with a team option to pick up multiple years after the end. And this has seemingly thrown some problems for David Malukas, given the fact that his healing progress with his wrist has not come along as quickly along. He's missed close to the first quarter of the season so far. He could, at least. And if he misses the Indy 500, that could be very problematic for his future at McLaren, especially when it very much seems that the team is now very high on Teo Pulcher, and Teo Pulcher seems to really want to be an IndyCar. I've actually never seen an F2 champion want to be an IndyCar as much as Teo Pulcher does. I actually really respect him for that reason alone. The fact that he won Formula 2, he should have a ride in Formula 1, and yet he's more excited to go race in IndyCar and race in the Long Beach Grand Prix than, you know, any of this. So it's just very interesting. We'll see what happens here going forward. But hey, that's not the only McLaren news. Fun fact about this, and this doesn't really have to do with the McLaren team, but someone very involved in the McLaren team, Penske Entertainment CEO Mark Miles, has reportedly recruited McLaren Racing CEO Zak Brown to be a part of a small new task force designed to help the IndyCar series improve its marketing efforts. Now, if you read, there's a great Racer article about this that I really recommend everybody read, because it kind of talks about how Zak Brown had some of his ideas. Some of them, you know, for the most part, are very good. I mean, he seems to recognize the problems that it has and has really tried to, you know, offer some help to fix that, which is great, you know. But he points out the fact that, and it's a very true fact, that Formula E has a higher value than IndyCar. And unfortunately, it is true. Formula E, a series that's only been around for 10 years. I mean, we're coming up on the 10th year of Formula E, and it has more value. It is worth more than IndyCar, a series that has over 100 years of history. So Zak Brown makes a very good point about that, but the only thing he doesn't make necessarily a great point about to some people is the fact that he, I guess, wants to introduce a cap the field. He wants to cap the field primarily to kind of artificially, I guess, drive up the value of the series. And he actually invoked NASCAR, saying that, you know, their value has gone up since you know, chartering 36 entries and only having 36, you know, and he brought up how it doesn't have to be 43. You know, I wish it was 43, but I digress. But yeah, it just interesting pieces of news there. Mark Miles, I guess, realizing he's not good at this anymore. Maybe he's finally, I don't want to say he's listening to me, because if he is, I apologize for hurting his feelings. But hey man, someone's got to tell you the truth at some point. Josh, do you have something to say? Because you have not spoken yet. We are now 7 minutes into the show and you have not spoken yet. I think you would like to say something.
Oh, this is Mutie, Josh. Mutie Roller. You know, look, I was just going to say that I think Zak Brown's got, he's got a heartbeat on a lot of different forms of racing. I think he's going to bring a lot of value to that, and that's something that Mark Miles isn't as well versed in, or at least currently. Maybe he once was, but not currently.
He never was.
You know, what can in all the forms of racing that McLaren is in, that Zak Brown's involved in, knows about. I almost think that Zak Brown might know more about even NASCAR than Mark Miles. So what can he bring in from these different portions of all these race forms of racing and governing bodies to try to improve IndyCar's worth, recognition, you know, overall value, and you're not stuck on, as we'll talk about a little bit later, USA.
Yeah. We'll talk about some, we'll move on now into some of the supercars news. This is kind of cool. The Northern Territories government has approved $3 million in upgrades for Hidden Valley Raceway. The upgrades are the first phase of a quote-unquote master plan to eventually bring shaded grandstands, new camping areas, and even lighting the track so that they can have a night race at Hidden Valley Raceway, which would be awesome. But for now, these upgrades are focused on facilities, accessibility, shading the pit area, bringing more garage space to the teams, building a new control tower, a medical center, and upgrading the entrance of the facility. So kind of cool there that the Northern Territories government has approved for those facilities upgrades, and I actually think that would be kind of cool. That would be really, really kind of cool to see a night race at Darwin. That would be pretty cool. But anyway, let's go ahead and move on into the next piece of news, because IROC is back, kind of. If I didn't sound very excited about that, here's why. IROC Holdings LLC, a group formed by former NASCAR team owners Ray Evernham and Rob Kaufman, who acquired the rights to the IROC brand earlier this year, have announced that the first IROC event is set to take place July 19th through 20th at Lime Rock Park as part of Speed Tour All-Star Race Weekend, featuring both an on-track racing exhibition and static display. The event will reunite original IROC competitors with cars actually raced in the Legendary Series. So to, you know, put a pin on all of that PR marketing speak, it's a vintage weekend.
Yes.
It's a vintage race weekend.
100%.
It's what it is. It is a vintage race weekend. If you've been to a vintage race, then you know exactly what you're going to get. This is not going to be, you know, an actual real competition. This is going to be a vintage race.
Boring.
Yes. Yes. But hey, if you're in Lime Rock, hey, I'd like to visit Lime Rock someday. So, hey.
Lime Rock is a pretty cool place. So at least it's happening at a pretty cool place.
Precisely. All right, let's move on to some NASCAR news, because this is going to be the last piece of the news segment before we move on into our next segment, which is our featured paint scheme, which is, you know, always fun to do. I always love the featured paint scheme. Moving on to some NASCAR news, if you watched the race at Talladega this weekend, then you know that Eric Jones was involved in a pretty bad accident there, which was really violent. I mean, quite literally, absolutely violent accident. And apparently he has a compression fracture in his back after the crash, and he will miss at least the next race at Dover, and apparently by then it's going to be, according to him, day by day. So he will be replaced by Corey Heim, who will be making his Cup Series debut at Dover. So it'll be Heim time in Dover in the 43.
Trucks that'll be off. Interesting. That's why.
Yeah, well,
he could be. I don't know if he's on the entry list for like Sam Hunt Racing, but I mean, the trucks are.
I mean,
off,
let's
so
be honest.
Have to worry about that.
He's
cross duty.
He's a good driver. I think it's very clear that he's a good driver. Is he going to be in way over his head? Absolutely. But I think the expectations for Corey Heim is that he should have no problems bringing the car home in one piece.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. When you're a sub driver like this situation, bring it home in one piece, top 30 if you can.
Yeah, yeah. So, like I said, even though he may or may not be in way over his head going to Cup like that, you know, he should be all right. I trust him. If Toyota trusts him, I'm going to trust him too.
Oh, yeah.
All right, and you probably also heard about this weekend, but this was kind of the big news of the weekend, really. Kyle Larson was disqualified from qualifying for Sunday's Geico 500 and was given a pass-through penalty at the start of the race for his team, making unapproved adjustments to his roof rails while pushing his car out to pit road. So NASCAR just said, no, you're not qualifying, you're done. You're done. I mean, it's a very severe penalty. Of course, thankfully it is Talladega, and we are in a stage racing era where there's going to be a caution and you're going to be able to get your lap back as long as you are the only car on the lead one lap down. And that is exactly what happened. And okay, you know, it is what it is. I mean, it's a harsh penalty, but at Talladega, it's almost meaningless. So
it's a harsh penalty, depending upon where you're at.
Yeah, true. Let's talk about some happy news. Cam Waters will make his second start in the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series with Thor Sport Racing at Kansas coming up here in a couple of weeks. That'll be great. That'll be a much different experience than Cam Waters has been doing. A 1.5 mile intermediate track like Kansas. It's one thing, you know, when you make your first start and it's on a short track, you know, there's room for error. You know, you can make contact, you can screw up, you know, your car is built, it's not an aerodynamic heavy track, you're not going super fast, you know, it's good learning track, good way to learn the car. And to go immediately from that into Kansas. Have fun, Cam. I'm excited, though. If SVG was able to handle Las Vegas okay, he should be all right. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, I think I like the variety. I think it's good.
It is good. I I am all for this. I am absolutely all for this. I, you know, we all thought it was going to be Brody, but no, it's Cam Waters. And I'm like, all right, let's go. Let's go, I mean, guys.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Can't wait to watch it.
Me neither, man. All right, let's go into the last piece of NASCAR news. NASCAR has revealed, or no, not the last piece of NASCAR news. I apologize. One of the last pieces of NASCAR news. But NASCAR has revealed the format for the 2024 All-Star Race, and it's going to be this. We're going to have some qualifying. Then we'll have qualifying, you know, and that'll be the standard All-Star qualifying with the pit stop in the middle. And then we'll have two heat races to determine the starting lineup of the A-Main, of the All-Star Race. The All-Star Open will be 100 laps. The main event will be 200 laps. But here's the big thing. Here's the biggest, coolest thing of them all is NASCAR and Goodyear will introduce an alternate tire as well as bring a wet weather tire to the NASCAR All-Star Race. So that means we'll have a primary tire, an option tire, and a wet weather tire. So depending on the weather, all three could be used.
Yeah.
Which would be awesome! It would be sweet. I'm getting ahead of myself. But here's how that's going to be. Teams will be allotted three sets of prime tires and two sets of alternates. Qualifying will take place exclusively on the prime tires. All cars will start on the alternate tires during the main event. So everybody, when they take the green flag for the All-Star Race for the 200-lap main event, everybody's going to have to start on these on basically a softer tire.
Yeah.
And that's going to be interesting. I'm very curious. I mean, to be honest with you, and it's not like it's a terrible idea. I mean, to be honest with you, most of the time in racing, when you start on the soft tire to start the race, it's because you're trying to make as many, you know, we'll literally talk about this later in the show, but it's because you're trying to make as pass as much as you can. But it would be interesting to see, you know, how that tire rail wear goes. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself because we will talk about this later in the show. But hey, according to Bob Pockrass, while he is eligible for the All-Star Race, apparently Shane Van Gisbergen has no current plans to enter the race, which is kind of disappointing. I really expected him to run it. I mean, he's eligible. Why not? I don't know what the harm in him not running is. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if the Project 91 is kind of set aside since there's a lot of funding coming from Trackhouse going towards Zane Smith and him and Shane at Colleague. And but maybe, yeah, there's still room. I mean, all they gotta do is have. I don't know when the deadline is, but you know, maybe this is something they're downplaying it. Maybe they hear something and Shane, you get asked, say there's no plans right now.
Well, and Allmendinger is eligible too, and I think that's what throws the wrench in because then he. Allmendinger is basically entitled to the 16.
Run the 13.
Now that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, but run that, but I mean, like, Shane SVG could run the 91 for Trackhouse. You know?
If Trackhouse brings the car, otherwise I would think Colleague would have to bring it. Maybe neither wants to bring it.
Right.
I have no idea. But it's just, I mean, that's just, all I have to go is off of Bob Pockrass' tweet. That's all he had, so. That's all he had. But, Bob. More on this later also. This is pretty huge. This was pretty massive, crazy news to drop on Monday. Sports Business Journal reports that Kroger sponsorship could be on the move, leaving JTG Doherty for Joe Gibbs Racing at the conclusion of the 2024 season. Good gracious. A lot of things to digest about that. We'll talk about that later on in the show, so get ready for that. But just because we don't want to jump into it right away, we're going to do into the featured paint scheme. We're going to do that because in honor of this weekend's Talladega winner, Tyler Reddick, we are going to do our standout Tyler Reddick scheme. Now, in all honesty, Josh, now that I think about it, maybe we should have done standout Scott Dixon scheme, but I do agree with the Tyler Reddick scheme, though, because he does have so many great ones that you could pick from, so I have really no problems, whereas Scott Dixon only ever drove, like, a handful of paint schemes in his entire life.
Like, it was you're talking about, Target. Like, five paint schemes,
yeah,
dude.
I mean, there's, like, five iconic paint schemes, but you'd have to go and pick something that's completely different, so... It's probably all right that we're doing this. So we just don't want people to think that, like, when we do the featured paint scheme, we're completely leaving out IndyCar. It's like, no, we're not doing that. Just Scott Dixon wins a lot.
he had Target, and then he had NTT. He had a couple, like, I think one-offs with some other people. Yes.
And at one time, he drove a Coors Light car in kart.
True. But instead, again, you're talking... I mean, the dude has ran less than 10 paint schemes, I think.
And that's crazy to me, too,
because... the last 25 years.
Yeah, he's literally... He's been in the series for over 20 years. And he's only got, like, 5 paint schemes. Yeah. All right, obviously, we're being flippant. He has more than 5 paint schemes, but 5 iconic paint schemes, we should say. Yeah. Liveries, however you want to say. But anyway, Josh, go ahead and tell us, what is your standout Tyler Reddick paint scheme?
Well, I'm going to tell you... There's one I when you say the name Tyler Reddick, I always think of this scheme. It's one of the ones that cycle through my mind, and it's his 2018 number 9 BurgerFi Chevrolet that he drove for Junior Motorsports and won in twice. There was only 2 wins that year, the bookends of the year, the first race of the year, and then the season finale. I like it. I don't know. I mean, first off, I love the green in it, and I love the white base. I think this is one of those rare schemes. This one might be a hot take in this particular situation, but I think if you would like to inverse the colors, it wouldn't look as good. I actually believe that it looks best with the white base and the green stripes and the black number. Love it. I kind of regret I had the opportunity to buy one of these cars at one time and I didn't take advantage of it. So I do regret not buying this car. It is one I still think about and cycles through my mind when you say Tyler Reddick. Even today, he says some great paint schemes with 2311. Has some great paint schemes with RCR, and I cycled through a couple of those, and I'm like, I'm still landing on BurgerFi, and I couldn't let that one pass. So that was my standout scheme for him, and I'm pretty sure for a long time, if not forever, when I think of Tyler Reddick, I'm going to think about this scheme at some point.
You know, it's so funny that you talk about the paint scheme you think about when you think about Tyler Reddick, because my paint scheme is exactly that to me. I love the 2022 3-Chi paint scheme. Obviously, you know I love that. I'm a big fan of that. But not the primary. Not the primary that everybody's talking about. I'm talking about the one that he ran in the summer, the patriotic scheme, where you could just barely see an American flag. It was like the car was like this charcoal kind of gray, and then... You had just barely, it was an American flag on the side of the car, and I just loved it. I basically fell in love with it from the moment that I saw it. I was like, this is the new iconic paint scheme for me. I like that. And don't get me wrong, I think that the primary 3-Chi schemes, and especially the one, the Bristol Dirt one, were inverse. Those were also great ones. Kyle Busch's last year is great. And, you know, I forgot to mention this in the news, but now that we're talking about 3-Chi, I guess they still sponsor Kyle Busch, still give RCR money, but in a much reduced role. They're only going to sponsor the team at Phoenix this year. And they have basically just cited, you know, political red tape with cannabis sponsorship, which makes sense when you think about it. But
yes, from a marketing and licensing standpoint, like if he would have to win with what's his other tobacco related sponsorship?
Stone. I think it's Zone.
Yeah. If he wins like with Zone or 3-Chi in like a big way, like or championship, like. What NASCAR can produce from a merchandise standpoint gets slashed by 70% thanks to the good old government and protecting kids, which I'm not against. But again, I'm like, come on, right. Like adult collectible on it, charge $5 extra,
which is just crazy to me because it's like, again, and I don't mean to like sit here up here on a soapbox, but if we're treating cannabis like a legal drug, right? Like we do alcohol, right? What is the difference between Tyler Reddick winning at Indianapolis in this paint scheme I just talked about and Dale Jr. winning the Daytona 500 with Budweiser? Like, what is the difference?
100 years of legality. I'm just saying.
Cannabis has only really been illegal for the last, 70 years.
Yeah, I just think it's that. I think it's just that it, and we think about our lifetime, our parents' lifetime, alcohol has been legal the entire time. Cannabis has not always been legal. I think it's going to take some time for those types of deals to work out. And, it's amazing what the government decides to pick on and consider a major issue. Who gives a crap? It's just a teacher. It's just a diecast. I think that's what the problem is. I love my 3G t-shirts.
They're great.
I mean, I think 3G would have loved to have more merchandise that was officially NASCAR licensed.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
They just couldn't because NASCAR had their hands tied. And, like, we would love to. We would love to sell it. We know you could sell it. We can't put our name on it.
I haven't been to a NASCAR race. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I haven't been to a NASCAR race since Michigan last year. But if I recall, or excuse me, Indianapolis last year. But you've been to a couple of races this year, right? NASCAR wise.
I just went to Bristol and then Texas last September since that time frame.
But two. Okay. So you've been to two more races than I have. How many people have you seen wearing the Kyle Kush t-shirts?
At Bristol, I don't recall seeing anybody wearing them.
Oh, okay. So then I must be crazy. Well, maybe, you know what? It could be where it was. Because in Michigan, obviously, it's legal. So I saw one out of every 10 people at that race had a Kyle Kush t-shirt on. I'm not joking about that. I'm not joking.
Yeah, it could be where you're at, and you're talking t-shirts. It's also colder in Bristol that day, so it could have been under the sweatshirts. But I don't recall seeing any, because I feel like that's something that would have drawn my attention on there.
And if you were in Bristol and
you're
listening,
and you wore a t-shirt, I just didn't see you.
Yeah, but I just remember seeing them everywhere at Michigan, and just thinking like, man, I have not seen, I just haven't seen something like that. In years, that many people wearing the same t-shirt, and for Kyle Busch of all people, like that's just, I think that goes to the power of that brand and then just Kyle's willingness to activate it. And it's just a shame that they feel like they can't sponsor the car anymore. I mean, they still want to be involved in NASCAR. They clearly see that there is a market there. It's just,
yeah. Well, and I think this zone thing, they're going to run the same thing. It's why, like at the Daytona, when Kyle was leading, like, please, Kyle, don't win. NASCAR didn't want Kyle to win that race.
Yeah.
It's not because he's been dominating. It's because we can't sell crap if he wins this race.
Right.
So this is the fight that our elected officials think is the one to fight on, and I mean it's absolutely stupid. I'm like, hold on, this isn't a big problem right now, Yeah. If you buy a t-shirt for a kid, guess what? If he wears it to school, he's probably not gonna be allowed to wear it, and that's fine. I don't care. I get it. But who cares if the kid, a 6-year-old's not going to start smoking because of a diecast they got at 6 years old. They're not. So
my first ever IndyCar race was Indy 500. I saw the Marlboro car win. How many cigarettes I've ever smoked, Josh?
Zero.
Exactly. I've never touched one.
Yeah. I was able to read again, this is before all these bans came out. In the early 2000s, but I got a program from Michigan at the Kmart 400 that I went to, and inside there was plenty of cigarette ads. They were like actual smoking because they couldn't depict that. They could only depict certain aspects of it. But I've never smoked a cigarette in my life either, so I don't think it worked.
Dude,
Madison Avenue needs to get the crap together and fix that.
Dude, you were talking about that. I was like, I read all the NASCAR Illustrated magazines. Mm-hmm. Every single one in the very back had a Winston cigarette ad. Every single one. Or a chewing tobacco ad that was owned by RJ Reynolds.
Yeah.
So like Kodiaks, you know, things like that. Every single issue. Every single issue. And it kept going. I remember it was like they were still putting them in like as late as like I think 2005. Like when Winston was like gone and out of the sport, like they were still putting Winston cigarette ads in those magazines. Like it and again, never smoked. And I remember very much reading those ads, actually seriously looking and reading those ads. And never smoked.
Yeah. Didn't
anyway. Work. All right, we'll move on into the upshift downshift. That would have been a fun upshift downshift, but we don't have to do it this one. We'll talk about several different topics. We have a handful of topics here, mainly NASCAR, F1, IndyCar. So if you're a supercars guy, you might want to skip over this to where we talk about supercars. But I digress. I do hope that you stick around anyway, because NASCAR, IndyCar, and Formula 1 have some interesting topics that are up for discussion. So, if you are new to the show, first of all, welcome. Second of all, here's how it's done. Josh and I will be presented with a series of hypothetical questions or statements and asked whether or not we upshift or downshift, meaning we agree or disagree. Upshift is agree, downshift is disagree. You can play along at home as well using the hashtag RobinRoller or tweeting us at RobinRoller, at RobinRoller. Go ahead and tweet at us. We'll post all of the questions out. And even if you are a Spotify listener, you can answer the Spotify question of the week right in the app. Don't even have to pull up Twitter. Don't even have to do anything. You can stay anonymous if you want. I don't care. Just go ahead and, you know, put your answer in and, you know, let us know what you think. So give us an upshift if you want to explain. I don't care. We love hearing from you. So we'll start off. Here's the first one. NASCAR's Steve O'Donnell said that the charter deal was quote-unquote close, but Denny Hamlin said his comments were quote-unquote positive messaging. Do you upshift or downshift that NASCAR is on the defensive when it comes to charter deals progression, Josh?
I upshift. I think NASCAR... I thought about this over the weekend when I first read this. I thought about it a few days, actually. I think all the teams are on the same page. What they want, that makes sense, right? The teams are all on the same page. Even JGT Daugherty and Hendrick Motorsports, they're all on the same page. They all know what they want. I think NASCAR, internally, you have different people on different pages. They don't know what they want from it. And then I think NASCAR is hoping that the teams are going to back down. I think the teams are also probably preparing some legal recourse. Because think about this. What do you think about this? NASCAR created these charters and assigned them to teams. Teams are and said, you can sell them. Teams have sold them. Spire spent $40 million on a single charter. Single charter. NASCAR takes that away. I'm pretty sure there might be some sort of law break in there that either says, okay, you got to repay us what we've paid or not. I think NASCAR is playing on the defensive here because I think they know the ball is in their court, and it's been pushed that way by the teams. Like, take a shot. It's all you. Time for you to come to the court and play. I think that's where they're at. I upshift 100% positive messaging because they're not on the same page. I don't even think they're on the same continent right now.
Well, I think you're probably right about that. You brought up a lot of good points. I think the main number one thing about this whole deal is what you touched on with Spire. I mean, that's a ridiculous amount of money to spend on what is essentially the right to be guaranteed a starting spot in NASCAR. And that's basically all it is.
You're and guaranteed minimum payment per year that can, yes. that could vary based off of how well that charter has performed right. over the past 3 years.
I was just about to get to that, sorry. But you're okay. You're fine. But you're absolutely right. You are exactly right. I think you said it a little bit better than I could anyway. You're absolutely right. That is essentially what you are paying that much money to do. And to be honest with you, I would feel like to me a complete slap in the face if I spent that much money and then I'm told that now it's not, you know, it's different now, you know, that was a waste of money. You know, it was necessary at this time, but now it's not necessary. I can't imagine the teams are going to stand for that, especially the way they are now. I mean, they're basically unionized. I mean, the RTA is, it's their union. Like, I mean, they have so much more pull than they ever have. The teams have never had this much pull in NASCAR because the Frances would never have allowed it. They're like, well, Bill France and Bill Sr. Bill Jr. Brian France could be easily persuaded by a man by the name of Rob Kaufman. Let's just say that. but I upshift that Hamlin's right. I think that NASCAR is definitely on the defensive. They know that things are not progressing as well as they need to be, but they're trying to make it seem as such so that they can continue to grow value and business jargon. That's what it is. All right, here's the next question here that I've got. Do you upshift or downshift that an alternate tire will help the quality of next-gen short track racing, Josh?
I'll upshift it if it's done right. I don't like teams being directed how to use them. I think that kind of defeats the purpose of having an option, right? How do you want to start? How do you want to play it? It also just depends on, okay, here's the regular tire. It lasts a 100 laps before start losing any time. Oh, here's your option tire. It lasts 90 before going away. That doesn't do much. You know, you're going to have to look at any car and see how their alternate and prime tires work. You know, you're going to have to make sure you're able to replicate something similar. So, but I do think if it's done right, it can. I think it is an option. I don't think it's the best and correct option to do. I think there's other ones we can do instead that we should be doing, but it's something. So I'll upshift.
That's fair. I mean, that's I upshift it. I think it will. I genuinely think an alternate tire. And here's the thing. I think this is what's so crazy about it is I feel like whatever they brought to Bristol was just way too soft, and I feel like Goodyear knows now that
if
this
know.
Is what it hopefully I would think that okay, we know this is what we're kind of looking for. And now here's the other caveat to that is I'm actually very curious to see how that option tire will perform on North Wilkesboro's new surface. The track's just been repaved, and I'm very curious to see how that option tire will do, whether or not it will last longer or less short, you know, wear faster, and how much of an option the prime tire could be, because that's the biggest issue that you don't want to have is you don't want that prime tire, because if the prime tire it doesn't fall off obviously as hard as the option tire, but the option tire doesn't really allow you more grip. So like if the option tire allows you to go on the outside and pass everybody for like 8 laps, you know, then I could probably see it being, you know, an effective way to gain some spots. But if it ends up, you know, only gaining you a handful of tenths here and there and not really giving you any real passing or grip advantage, that's the thing that I'm worried about. So it all comes down to what that new North Wilkesboro surface is like. But I do upshift it. I think that it's a good choice. I think it's a good idea. And I think that hopefully it should, especially if everybody has to start in the prime tire. If worst case scenario, like I just said, where the prime tire doesn't really help with any grip advantage, doesn't really help with passing, you know, I think that having everybody start on the prime tire is probably the best option. Because then that will at the very least make that first kind of stint very interesting. And then after that, what you get is what you get. But anyway, we'll move on here. Lance Stroll was to blame for the incident between him and Daniel Ricciardo. Do you upshift or downshift this, Josh?
I'm going to go out on a very, 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 very thin limb, and I'm going to downshift.
Oh.
I'm going to blame the rules. The way where Max was starting, this is just like Laguna Seca with IndyCar, right? You had people accelerating in decelerating at the same time, it's going to happen. If IndyCar, or excuse me, Formula One, at that track, I'm like, okay, Max, you got to hit the gas by this point on that long straight in order for people not to have this happen. Do I think outside the rules? Yeah, Lance was probably to blame on it, maybe. But I actually think it was just rules that they're laid out, and I can't say they're right or wrong, but the way Max waited as long as he could to go, that was what you get. You're going to have the front half decelerating while the back half is accelerating because their crew said Max is on the gas, right? So, hot take, but when you pull back the curtains, that's what I see.
Sorry, yeah, I'm rewatching it now because obviously I didn't realize that the Chinese Grand Prix was going to be on at 3 a.m. Really crazy. But the way I look at it, it's on Stroll, man. It's on Stroll. I mean, I hate to be that guy, but it's on him, man. I don't know.
I don't think you're wrong. I will say, I mean, if you close the curtains, you're right. I think it is 100% on Stroll's fault.
I mean, it's just, how do you not know the closing speed? How do you, I mean, I understand. I mean, I get the circumstances, but at the same time, hold on, let me watch this again. I mean, you can clearly tell that there is an accordion. I mean, it's, and maybe it's the onboard effect. Maybe it's because I could see what the onboard is. And maybe if I saw Stroll's, you know, helmet cam, maybe I'd have a little bit of a different opinion of that. But even then, it's like, you have to brake for the corner anyway. Where did he think he was going to go? I mean, and even then, if Max did launch, wouldn't the ideal option be to, like, get your front wing clear out of the dirty air from the car in front of you? Like, so that you could,
Well, I think in this point where that corner is, it's positioning for the launch off.
Yeah.
And if you're further down, that's going to tighten your corner radius, which is going to slow your exit speed, which opens him up to be passed from the rear.
again, it is one of circumstantial.
I don't even think you can blame Ricardo for it.
Oh no, I don't think
Ricardo's just. No. I mean, Ricardo's just reacting to what the McLaren's doing in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
Like what's he supposed to do? I mean, in my opinion, this is on Stroll. This is him not paying attention to what's going on in front of him. I mean, that closing rate, yeah, I get it. But at the same time, it's just like, okay, bruh, break. I don't know how, if he's looking down and not paying attention. It looks like he attempts to swerve one way and then, yeah, it's on him, man. It's on him. I'm not gonna try and defend this anymore. I'm gonna give it on him, and I'm gonna move on. Eliminating stage cautions at Super Speedway is the answers to teams and drivers deciding to slow the pace of the race. Do you upshift or downshift this, Josh?
Yes, 100% upshift. Right? If NASCAR's got a problem with this, has a problem with the teams just riding around trying to hit a fuel number on a Super Speedway to hit. Know when cautions are going to go to. We know we're going to have a caution fly here. We got to hit a fuel number to get there. Slow the pace down. And then everyone else is on board for that too. Yes, eliminate the stage cautions. Eliminate the stage cautions. That makes you don't know when the next caution is going to fly. You want to be up front. You don't know when the next adjustment is going to be. You want to be up front. Eliminate them.
Yeah.
You can still have you can still wave or hold out the checkered flag indicating that that stage is over, but you're still going. That's fine. Get rid of the caution part.
Well, I think they should be doing that, period.
I mean, I agree.
I think that should be the case. But no, to your point is I downshift. I don't think that there's any problem with. I don't get why everybody's so uptight about that. I don't understand.
I'm not necessarily uptight about it.
I'm not saying you are. I'm saying like
have
Twitter
a problem
is.
With it. That's how you solve it.
Yeah. I'm saying like Twitter is. Twitter's all up in arms all the time that, I hate when everybody starts to go slow and everybody starts fuel saving. I'm like, why? What's wrong with that? It's a fuel mileage race. Oh, no. Like, what? And a lot of, journalists like Jeff Gluck were bringing up good points. Like, would you rather this, which still has three wide racing, or would you rather them just all ride the top? Yeah. Like,
I mean,
take
that's
your
a
pick,
great
man.
Point.
What we have right now is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. And if you want my opinion, too, I think it makes for a more interesting race when it otherwise would just be some, random gridlock of watching traffic go 200 miles an hour. You know, at least now you're looking at fuel strategy playing into account, and you're looking at, all right, well, what's more important, the fuel strategy or the stage points or this and that? You know, it's, to me, it makes for more interesting super speedway style racing than what we've had in the past. I don't understand the problem with it. Now, yes, again, to your point, Josh, I agree. I think just eliminating stage cautions altogether would solve 90% of the problems. But I digress. If we have to have stage cautions, I'm not bothered by cars not going 100% because let's not act like they're going 100% at any other race. If you're fuel saving at a place like Pocono or at a place like Michigan or at a place like we're going to this weekend like Dover, all you're doing is just getting off the gas sooner when you go into the corner and picking up the throttle later. You're also lowering the speed. You're lowering the pace of the race. They're doing the same thing. It's no different. The only difference is they're doing it in a pack here, whereas at Dover they're doing it by themselves. That's the only difference to that.
I think it's just sort of the nature of the race that bugs people. I think that's why. But again, we talked about this before. There's two halves to NASCAR fan bases. When one's happy, one's mad. When one's sure. quiet, the other one's complaining. You can't win with these things.
Yeah, I guess you can't. I mean, but even then, I don't want NASCAR to overreact and change something, change the stage lengths or change the fuel cells or what have you.
Yeah.
Because I don't want them to overreact because a bunch of fans are angry that they're not going balls to the wall for 500 miles. There's no reason for that. There should be no, under no circumstances should any race be balls to the wall for 500 miles. That is asinine. That is straight. It's never happened. It's never happened in the history of endurance racing. And when I say endurance racing, I mean races of, 250 miles or more. You will never see that. It blows my mind. All right. Moving along. Do you upshift or downshift that the 70% drop in Long Beach ratings stresses the need for IndyCar to be on broadcast networks, Josh?
Yeah, I think it does. Which makes this next TV deal very interesting, especially if it's going to go onto Fox and they're going to put them on FS1. It's going to be very interesting. Especially with Fox having football in the fall.
Well, and they have spring football now with the UFL.
I don't know. I mean, just think about that. You went from having 1 million people watch it to having one of the, they say maybe the biggest crowd ever. It's certainly at least the biggest crowd since unification at Long Beach. But you had a 70% drop in television viewership. That's bad. I don't even know where to begin to complain about that, Rob. So, but I'm going to upshift. If they were on NBC, they wouldn't be having this problem. They probably would have been around the 1 million mark and watching this race, and instead, they weren't. Very sad.
You know, it's funny that you say that. Honestly, I don't think that's the case. I saw some numbers that this is actually, this was extremely comparable to the numbers they were getting when Long Beach was on NBCSN. In fact, the numbers maybe differ by, maybe a few thousand people.
Really?
Yeah.
But
it's not like it's that different. The fact of the matter is, here's the other thing. I don't think it being on NBC would have mattered that much. Would it have helped it a little bit? Yes. But it was still going up against Talladega. And when you're talking about race fans, when you're talking about legitimate race fans, no matter what, it's going to be a very, very hard ask for someone to not watch Talladega. Okay? It's going to be a very hard ask because it's Talladega. There's nothing like it. There is nothing like it. It is what NASCAR is known for. Now, and I say that knowing full well that the Long Beach Grand Prix is also an extremely prestigious race. It is an extremely popular race. It is one of my favorite IndyCar races. Personally, I have such great memories watching the Long Beach Grand Prix with my dad, watching the Long Beach Grand Prix, all over the place. I love it. It's a great race. But again, you cannot have IndyCar and NASCAR go up against each other because you just, that's the biggest problem that they have. And IndyCar doesn't really have much of a choice, right? No, they don't really have a lot of a choice many times. Like, this was a situation where, you get what you get. But again, to the point of that, imagine if they had started it at 3 p.m. local time instead of noon local time. Because remember, they started it at noon local time.
Yep.
If they had started it at 3 p.m. local time. Then it would have started at after the Talladega race, and it would have basically been an evening race. And here's the thing. It's not like USA had anything. It would be basically be on prime time in the East Coast, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not like NBC or USA had anything planned. Again, it was just SVU marathons. And again, I like SVU, but come on. It's not like it's that big of an important thing that you can't run an IndyCar race a little bit later. Right. So, but again, I'm not going to stress that too much. I'm going to attribute it to... I'm not going to say that it's you know, it means IndyCar has to be on broadcast. It's just things on cable. I mean, look, if you look at what... If NASCAR moved, put something on FS1 that used to be on Fox, it's going to drop in ratings. It's just the nature of how it is. People don't have cable anymore, and the people that do make up a very small percentage of that number. What I would be more interested to know is, what are the Peacock numbers? How are the Peacock numbers?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm more interested in. You know, because if you combine the linear TV viewers and the Peacock viewers, I'm pretty sure you're going to get a little bit closer to what, you know, you're looking for.
I wish we got those numbers that we could say, like, okay, hey, you know, this is how many people watch Talladega on TV, down 2%, but we actually had 2%, that 2% watch on FoxSports.com and another 5%. So we had that many people watching. I wish we could get those numbers so we could actually see how many people are watching, because, like, I've viewed several. Or, like, it's the same thing with the Indy 500 in Indiana when they black it out. I've watched several Indy 500s from the view of a driver's video. It's a 15-second delay, but that's how I've watched several 500s, was from Will Power's onboard camera, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm watching it from his view. How many people are doing that as well? So, yeah, I mean, it
And then, of course, you have a whole bunch of people that are obviously bootlegging it, too. So, you could, sure. If you really want to get into the nitty-gritty, you got to wonder how many people are doing that. But I'm just not going to sound the alarm too much about it. I don't think it's... I feel like if this was the case for any other race, like, it would be a significant drop. You know, it's... I mean, look, if they do an all-star race next year and it's not on broadcast or something, I can guarantee you that's going to have a huge drop. And people are going to freak out about that and say, okay, well, it's time to end it. And it's like, no, it was just on cable. Like, less people had access to it. When you put something on broadcast over the air, people only have about 30-some channels. All right, they're going to run out of things to watch in a weekend.
Right.
And this is what inflates ratings with that. So, I don't know. I downshift. I don't think it's that big of a deal, in all honesty. I think I'd rather worry about how things are going on the streaming side of things. That would be my biggest concern. Next piece of question here. Lewis Hamilton told Sky Sports that he'd race well into his 40s. Do you upshift or downshift that Fernando Alonso will race into his 50s, Josh?
Rob, do you see any sign of him slowing down?
Absolutely not. The dude still has... He is like Scott Dixon. I think Fernando Alonso and Scott Dixon are basically two of the same.
I upshift. I think Fernando is going to be around for a while. I don't think he's going anywhere. Done. That's all I got to say about it.
I wholeheartedly upshift with you as well. And I don't want him or Scott Dixon to retire ever. I want to see that just how long they can go and stay at the top of their game, because very clearly they still are.
I want to see 76-year-old Scott Dixon win his second Indy 500.
And his ninth IndyCar championship and 72nd win.
Well, we're probably closer to like his 13th championship, and if not more, in his 112th win. So yeah,
I just think he's got to get to the seven. He's got to join the seven time club. Championships. He's got to join the seven time club, because that is an exclusive club in any motorsport. Right. The only other person that comes anywhere even close to that is Frank Kimmel's 10 ARCA championships. Which is still baffling to me that was even accomplished when ARCA was actually full of competitive race cars. At least the drivers Frank Kimmel was competing against were competitive.
True.
Anyway, let's go. Speaking of Scott Dixon, Scott Dixon's victory Sunday at Long Beach with his team's fuel-saving strategy is the most impressive win of his career. Do you upshift or downshift this, Josh?
You know, Rob, I'm not as well-versed, and I don't have as great a memory for the car as you do. But I will say this. I upshift that it is certainly a top three contender. Like, that was unreal. When I went back and I watched it and I'm reading about it, I'm like, how the heck did this guy do this? Like, did he have a longer fuel line in that car? Did he pull something Smokey Yunick did back in the day in that Indy car? What did he do? He clearly knew when to brake and when to gas it up. So I think it is exceptionally impressive. Top three for sure. No doubt about that in my mind. I feel like that's a tough one to beat.
I mean, this is definitely top three. I mean, this was an insane drive. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, I have. I mean, it's Scott Dixon. I've seen him save fuel like only Scott Dixon can, but even then, this was still something to behold for sure. I would probably have to upshift this. This is, again, yeah, absolutely in the top three of his most impressive wins. Let's move on here into the next one. Do you upshift or downshift the idea of the top 12 finishers in Formula One being awarded points without additional entries being permitted on the grid, Josh?
I said a long time ago that I think that, you know, if you have 22 cars, 11 cars should earn points. If you have 24 cars, 12 cars should earn points. And I'm going to stick to that. You know, if Formula One were to add an 11th team, ergo two core cars, then you could award 11 cars points. I'm very okay with that. I know why they're wanting to do this. I know why some team owners want to do it. Up on even towards the front of the field and certainly towards the back. But I still don't think they should. I want to downshift.
We've got the question here. I downshift this. So you got to add teams to the field, before you can start awarding more points in a Grand Prix, more cars and entries points in a Grand Prix. So I downshift it. Don't think that's going to happen though, but because I think this is very much going to go through, but I downshift.
Well, I mean, absolutely. This is a hands down downshift for me. I've been saying it for years on this show that if you're not going to increase the car count, then go back to awarding the top six. Because there's the reason why, again, when the FIA granted Marussia, then known as Virgin Racing, Caterham, then known as Lotus Racing, and HRT, entries to the grid in 2010, they said, all right, well, now we've got 24 cars on the grid, so we're going to award the top 10 points. Okay? That's what they did. And that made sense, because there were 24 cars on the grid. Since then, the grid has compressed to 20 cars. So we are now awarding half the field points. And that is unnecessary. Half the field does not need points. Points in Formula One used to matter, used to mean something, used to be reserved for the best of the best. The drivers that finished in the top six were awarded points. Top eight were awarded points. Right? Either or. You know, and that was how championships were determined. Meaning, you could not have this, you know, 10th, 11th place, you know, 10th place run, or, you know, 8th place, 7th place run and earn points. It was just, no, if you finish 7th, tough. Or if you finish 9th, tough. You know? Now, and that was back, again, when the F1 grid was 20 cars. 18, 20 cars. Maybe 22 cars. Made sense. But when they had 24 cars, okay, it made sense to expand it to the top 10. But without it, now you're... Why does the 12th place car need to earn points? Why? I can't explain. I've never understood that. Why would a 12th place car need to earn points?
In Formula
1. Why? They don't. Not in Formula 1. If Formula 1, you're going to call yourselves top echelon of motorsport, then your points should be reserved to only the fastest cars. And the fastest drivers. It should not be given out to people who don't even finish in the top 10.
I would agree.
That's top insane. Half. Yeah. I mean, top 10 already is pushing it, in my opinion. I mean, it's not perfect, but I'm not going to say that I hate it, right? But at the same time, top 12, no. I mean, come on. We got to draw the line somewhere. I mean, that's ridiculous. And anyway, that is my take on that. Penultimate question here. If Kroger leaves JTG Doherty at the end of the 2024 season, do you upshift or downshift that the team will sell its charter, Josh?
This is a tough one. I mean, it already sounds like we're going to have two for sale from Stuart Haas. And I think there's probably five ownership groups, let's put the wordage like that, that are interested in a additional charter or a charter. Yeah, it's they have such a strong relationship with Kroger and the brands there. They have very few races that aren't associated and don't come from the Kroger branding and partnerships. So I think it would be very high likely that we could see JTG Doherty go. So I'm sadly going to upshift. Sadly.
Well, I mean, it's not looking good. It's not good when an anchor sponsor like that pulls the plug out from under you and goes to sponsor a team that probably doesn't need it. Really doesn't need it. They really don't need it. And it's honestly also, I think, 2 years too late. They probably could have used that big sponsorship when Kyle Busch was renegotiating. Probably would have helped a lot. Who knows? Maybe if Martin Truex retires, maybe Kyle Busch will go back.
That could be where, I mean, let's be honest. If Martin Truex goes, do you think the Bass Pro Shops brand, and even the auto owner's insurance brand, because they've been with him for a while, do they go with anyone that's in lower divisions right now or even currently in Cup unless it was Noah Gragson?
No.
Think about it.
I think only Bass Pro Shops would probably put more money behind Gragson.
Yeah.
But I don't think they would stick. I don't see any reason for them to stick with Gibbs. They have no reason to.
No, that's it. The Truex. So yeah. I think they're kind of preparing like, okay, Truex is going. We're going to lose Bass Pro Shops. We need to find a bigger sponsor. We need to find a big sponsor to come in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even then, in regards to JTG Doherty, I would hate to see them go. I would hate to see them go. I would not hate to see Ricky Stenhouse go. But I would hate to see JTG Doherty go. That's for sure. Josh, you're looking at me.
No,
I thought you were laughing at my shot at Ricky Stenhouse.
No,
but I will be very, very curious. I'm worried. I'm worried, and I do upshift this. I think that probably the end is near for that 47 team, unfortunately. Unless someone swoops in at the last minute, buys the team, or comes in and has a sponsor that's anywhere near there. I mean, unless, you know, I have no idea. Maybe they can negotiate, you know, start negotiating for next year, and maybe they won't have to. I don't know. I don't want to say too soon, but right now it definitely doesn't look good, so I'll upshift it for now. All right, on the last question today, do you upshift or downshift? An excessive blocking penalty could have prevented the final lap crash at Talladega, which was triggered by Michael McDowell. Josh, what's your take on that?
Oh, boy. I will say this. People are afraid of penalties. People are afraid of breaking the law in most general cases. And if they were to have an excessive blocking penalty, as in, hey, you had your one, you went for two. Even if you don't wreck the field, it's a starting place penalty for next week. Or whatever they deem it be. I don't know. I just hate that no one has figured out how to block and figure out, you know what, I'm done. I had my shot and it didn't work, right? And I'm not picking on Michael McDowell, it's just the latest example. But because Michael McDowell threw another block, we had a lot of torn up race cars that otherwise probably would have made it to the finish line unscathed. After a very clean race in general. So that's kind of a bummer to see. So, I guess I upshift. I think if there was a penalty, that we see it in other forms of motorsport, primarily open wheel. You get one block, it's the second one they get you on, right? So, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how we fix this because I'm tired of wadding up cars because of bad blocks. I mean, I thought TJ Majors was up on the tower there for Michael McDowell and not Brad Keselowski. So, anyways, Rob, what do you think?
I downshift, honestly. I don't think there's anything we can do to stop the blocking. It's the nature of the racing. The blocking has been around since this style of pack racing has existed. I mean, drivers have thrown crazy blocks, insane blocks. The problem is, I think there was a time, if you go back and you watch older restrictor plate races from back in the day, the blocks were just as crazy. It's just for whatever reason, I think it was the closing rate wasn't as high, or the respect Correct. Level was a little bit higher, where you Both. Could react. You know, you could react when a car was moving up on you. You know, you moved up. No, don't get me wrong. That would still sometimes trigger a big wreck. It did. It did frequently. But there was a little bit more respect there. And I don't know that a penalty is necessarily going to deter drivers from throwing the block. Because at the end of the day, they're going to throw the block no matter what. Because if you don't, especially in McDowell, if I'm in McDowell's shoes, if I am in McDowell's shoes, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not doing anything different. I'm not going to do a darn thing different if I am in McDowell's shoes. And I don't personally think McDowell did anything wrong anyway. I think he did everything right. I think the problem was he came down in front of Keselowski. I think he had just, I think it was more, it's more on the spotter than it is McDowell. The spotter should have told McDowell because especially since he's, you know, at that point you're like right in front of him, right? It's like,
when
hey, bud, all right.
At them, they can't see. They're looking at the cars.
Well,
this
I
way.
Guess you're right, but even then, it's one of those things where it's like I think it's he gave him the information and McDowell reacted, and the closing rate came too fast, right? I think if the closing rate was just a little bit slower, I think McDowell would have been fine. I think he would have made the successful block. Now, do I think Keselowski would have then immediately tried the outside? Absolutely. And would McDowell have blocked the outside? Absolutely. Would he probably would have wrecked himself then? Yes, absolutely. You know, I know when this stuff's going to happen, Josh. That's the fun part about being a race fan for so long is I can remember that there was a time I guess a little bit longer ago than I like to think, but really not too long ago, where the big one was far less predictable.
Yeah.
There, you know, now you know that the big one is not going to strike until the final 10 laps. But there used to be a time where the big one could strike any time. It could strike at lap 5. It could strike at lap 70. It could strike at lap 124. You don't know. It could come any time. It could come by complete surprise. It didn't always happen at the very end. And it now always happens at the very end, and you just know what's going to happen. So in my opinion, I don't think McDowell could have done anything different if he's trying to win the race. If he's trying to win a race, there's nothing he's going to do differently. He's going to do the same things, penalty or not. If McDowell gets, if they're saying, nope, you only can block once, you can't, you know, go high and low, well, drivers are just going to be mad at that because now they have no chance to defend their position. There's no chance. You know, and then what do you do? You just have to say, oh, well, this guy knew I was going to block, so he went high, and now I can't go high to block him now, otherwise I'll get a penalty. Well, tough. You know, they're not going to do that. It's going to open a whole can of worms. The fact of the matter is, it's just they got to do something about this closing rate, and I think drivers just have to have a little bit more respect. It's at the end of the day, I think it's a racing deal, and McDowell did, if it's anyone else, McDowell did what anyone else would have done. Again, I put myself in his shoes. If I'm in his shoes, I watched the in-car, the onboard. Based on what my spotter's telling me in my ear, what his spotter's telling him in his ear, I'm not doing anything different. No reason to. And that's just my viewpoint of it. I don't have any reason to think that a penalty would deter it or that it's something that needs deterring. Blocking is going to exist. They put NASCAR, in order to prevent insane blocking, which you used to see, which was horribly dangerous, they instituted the yellow line rule, and that basically solved that problem. Now these things are self-policing. I hate wadding up cars as much as the next guy, but that brings me to a completely different point, which is I'm not going to get into, but I will say that if you really want to fix these problems, and if you really want to, number one, make teams hate restrictor plate racing a lot less. Number two, make an argument for practice to come back. Yeah. And number three, I think what NASCAR really needs to do is they need to figure out a way on how to make these cars cheaper. That's what they need to do. I think they need to figure out some kind of way to make these cars cheaper. They're too expensive.
100%.
They're too expensive. And I think, you know, even then that they're too expensive, these cars keep wadding them up, and we shouldn't be doing that. I mean, if we're going to wad these cars up like we do all the time, at least make them cheaper to replace. But right now, we're racing what, like, these cars aren't, you know, what, 400,000, or what? What is it? What is 4 million or something? It's some four number, right?
Probably close to $1 million.
Right. It's a ridiculous amount of money for just one of these cars. Whereas 10,
something
20
that
years ago,
reduced the price.
Right. I mean, 10, 20 years ago, this was not the case. And right. You were spending more money on aero, and you were spending more money on other things. It's just, I don't know. I'm frustrated by it. But Josh, we'll wrap up the weekend here. We'll go ahead and go through the weekend's winners. NASCAR was in Talladega, as we've been talking about. ARCA, Jake Finch led every single lap, which should tell you how the ARCA race was. It was garbage. It was awful. It was awful, Josh. It was just awful.
ARCA should not be at Talladega. Not anymore.
I don't want to agree with you. I like when they're at Talladega, but that was an awful race. That was just a PU. That was a stinker. I mean, good gracious. I mean, the only saving grace was Frankie Muniz ran in the top 5 like most of the day. That was like the only saving grace of that race. Everything else just sucked. Oh my gosh. But then in Xfinity race, Jesse Love won his first ever Xfinity race. Because I guess RCR cars are just OP on restricted plate rate tracks or super speedways or whatever the hell they're called this week. Yeah, and then in Cup Series, Tyler Reddick quite literally stole one. I mean, props to NASCAR for letting him race back, though. I appreciate that. Really, really do appreciate that. I think that was a great little touch, there. Is that no controversies? No controversies. Now, maybe some Brad Keselowski fans probably wish they would have thrown the caution as soon as McDowell hit the wall, but Can't help you.
Yeah.
The ARCA West was actually in action this weekend. They were at the Kern Raceway. Cole Ross won that race. And then Supercars, they were finally in, you know, they made their debut back in this new track in Taupo. And Andre Heimgartner, a Kiwi himself, a New Zealander, won that race. So that was pretty cool. And that was a big win for Brad Jones Racing as well. And that was a good, very excellent race in the rain as well. I enjoyed watching that race very much. A good old rain race. Now, of course, it did get out to a good start. Big crash there for Cam Waters. That was definitely not good. But for the most part, everybody, you know, it was a good race after that. After the, you know, somewhat like hour-long-ish red flag that they had because it was raining too hard, I guess. But then in the second race, Will Brown won, and that was a good race for him. But, you know, I was kind of hoping for, you know, another non-Red Bull or non, you know, just non-Red Bull car to win, if that makes any sense. Especially since, like, that race, and then I knew the F1 race was literally on, like, right after. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to watch another Red Bull car win here in a little bit now. Not looking forward to that, but good to see Supercars back in New Zealand. Good to see Taupo have a very, very good showing there in the crowd and the good races. So, and then again, Formula One had the sprint race. This was sprint race weekend in China. First Chinese Grand Prix since 2019, Josh. And let me tell you something. There's one thing I missed about the Chinese Grand Prix, and I will always say this. I will forever say this. The front stretch at the Shanghai Speedway Shanghai Raceway is my favorite. I love how cool that front stretch looks with the big, you know, big columns and towers and things and this big, you know, kind of awning, I guess, that overlooks the track that's like, you know, luxury seats. I love it. I have loved it since I was a kid. I have always thought that that is like the coolest thing. And I would always love, like, if I was ever in China and I ever got to see this race, I would love to just see what it's like to watch the start from like up above, you know, literally like watch the start and watch the whole field go underneath you, like to take off. And then like, just, oh my gosh. Oh, I would love that. I always thought it was so cool. So it was, for me at least, it was kind of cool to see the Chinese Grand Prix back because I missed that Arcus texture very, very much. So, but yeah, Max Verstappen, of course, swept the whole weekend. Who gives a crap? You know, outside of that, we had great midfield battles. Some outstanding midfield battles, especially even in the sprint race. The sprint race had some incredible midfield battles for points in a race that didn't even really matter. I was thrilled. That was great, great stuff. So just a little reminder that the Shanghai International Circuit still does produce some good racing every now and again. And then IndyCar was in Long Beach. Scott Dixon quite literally did the impossible and stretched an unbelievable amount of fuel to go the distance, which I think Mike Hull said something. I think I read a quote from Mike Hull where he was like, he didn't even expect Dixon to do it. He didn't expect them to do it. He fully thought they were going to run out on the last lap. Like, he had no reason. And it's crazy because he's like, he has full belief in Scott Dixon, but he looks at the numbers and he's like, no, we should not be able to go this long. But he's hitting all the fuel numbers and he's still leading. He's hitting all the fuel numbers and still he's hitting the fuel numbers. Fuel. His pace is still good. How is he doing this? How is he doing this? How is he doing any of it?
It'll be in his book when he retires at the age of 77.
Oh my gosh.
How to save fuel at Long Beach.
Oh my gosh. Scott Dixon is, you can't even get mad at it's one of those things where you can't even be mad. How do you even be mad at it? You just have to sit there and just think, damn, I wish I could do that. Oh my gosh. Okay, Josh, You've got a very interesting featured driver for this weekend. Why don't you go ahead and tell us who is your featured driver?
Yeah, so this week, for this week's featured driver, I rolled back to 1960, the Formula One season then. Selected that season's British Grand Prix at the then 4.710-kilometer Silverstone Circuit. I then picked Robert Bodle's LTD driver, David Piper from Edgware, England.
Okay.
And here's the fun part. He entered only three F1 Grand Prix. When I saw that, I'm like, I'm sticking with it. I'm not changing it. Sticking with it. And he actually only started two. His first one was the 1959 British Grand Prix, which took place at Aintree in Liverpool, England. The race was won by Jack Brabham, who led all 75 laps, followed by Stirling Moss and Bruce McLaren. Piper started 22nd and retired, finishing 21st due to overheating after completing only 19 laps. His second Grand Prix was in the 1960 French Grand Prix at Reims, where, however, he did not start after qualifying 22nd, so therefore he doesn't get credit for starting the race. And that's where he only gets two F1 starts, but he gets three entries. Then his final Grand Prix was the one as I selected from, the 1960 British Grand Prix. It was his best Grand Prix, luckily. He qualified 23rd, but finished 12th, finishing five laps down in the 77-lap event won by Jack Brabham. He also started 8 24 hours of Le Mans between 1960 and 1970. It was definitely an endurance race back then because he only finished two of them. His car that he drove only finished two of them. In fact, the 1964 race, he didn't even complete a lap due to an oil pipe failure. Imagine, you go through all that, and you don't even complete a lap.
Oh my gosh.
What a bummer. He finished the best of six in his first attempt, where he completed 312 of 339 laps that were completed. So, yeah, there you go. David Piper, everybody. That was the guy I picked, and I stuck with it. And I'm like, I'm not changing it.
No, I respect it. I respect it. That's, see, when I'm learning something on this show, that's how you know it's a good show. That's how you know, you picked someone I've never even heard of. Probably most of our audience didn't know. And now we know. Now we're familiar with him. And I appreciate, I'm glad to know now about David Piper's escapades in Formula One during the 1960s and 70s. And I guess Le Mans in the 70s. Sorry, just the 60s. I forgot how... I'm sorry. Anyway, final word. Final word of the show. This is when Josh and I deliver our final statements. Josh, what is your final word for the show?
I think RCR picked a good horse when they picked Jesse Love. Jesse Love has made... Let me look here. Talladega was race 9. Talladega was race 9 of the season. Not race 9 of Jesse Love's career. He already did something that Sheldon Creed couldn't do in 2 years.
Ow.
Yeah, sorry. I'm going to go there. I like what I'm seeing out of Jesse Love this year in that 2 car. I think him and Austin have a lot of chemistry. It was always a very interesting choice with Austin Hill and Sheldon Creed, where they were kind of rivals in the truck series. Not necessarily didn't always get along. So seeing them both under the same roof, I thought was always a very interesting choice by RCR management. And now you have two guys who are getting along. Their cars are just freaking great on super speedways, man. It doesn't matter if it's Atlanta, Daytona, or Talladega. They are great. So, but Jesse Love, I like what I'm seeing out of him. I think he's a championship contender for sure. He's only getting better at each race. So looking forward to seeing what he does the remainder of the 2024 season here. Rob, what's your final word?
Well, my final word is just kind of to piggyback off something I was alluding at earlier. I really do feel like the solution to most of NASCAR's problems right now are just to simply make the cars cheaper. Cars are too expensive. Everything's too expensive. And there's got to be some way to make these cars cheaper. And there's got to be some way to have more practice. Because to be honest with you, I think a lot of what we see in the Cup Series, especially with the super speedway races, and especially in the lower divisions, can be attributed to a lack of practice. And a lack of these drivers really knowing what they're doing. I mean, you get the ARCA series gets more practice, and they barely race. And that's sad to me. That's incredibly sad to me, that the ARCA series gets more practice, and they don't even utilize that extra practice in the race by actually running in a pack and making moves and doing any of that. You know, that's sad to me. That's pathetic to me. You know, whereas we should be having an hour's worth of practice so that these drivers can figure out how their cars are going to work and how they're going to handle and how they're going to do, so that when they get into these crunch time situations, they're not kind of throwing caution into the wind. They have an idea. They know what their car is about. They know what their car is capable of. And again, not to say that this is a wholehearted change, you know, because guys were still going crazy back when we were doing practice, back in like 2019. You know, guys were still going crazy back then. But even then, the cars were cheaper. It was easier to replace them. And now it's not. It's just not. And we're still doing this. I just think NASCAR in general, and it has a lot of issues. And it goes back to not just this, not just that, but then also the charter agreements, the quality of things. NASCAR's not perfect, right? And while it's important to understand that NASCAR has been doing a lot of really great things, and I don't want to make it seem like my final word is just trashing NASCAR, just trashing them. No, I don't think that, I don't want that to be that way. They have quite literally invented themselves a nice renaissance, I think, with the introduction of the next-gen car. But there's a lot of kinks that need to get worked out, and there's a lot of other things that don't have anything to do with the next-gen car that have been stripped away, that now that we have this competitive racing, this competitive car, we don't have the things that we used to have that people really latched onto and really enjoyed and got to see out of this. And I think that's a problem. I think that's a substantial problem that NASCAR has. And it's not just about the practice thing. It's not just about making the cars cheaper. It's not just, there's a lot more layers to it that I can't really get into with just this segment. But I'll put a pin on it here, and I'll just say that my final word is that while NASCAR had a great race at Talladega, I think that there's still things that can be improved upon as a whole. And I think that the most important thing, again, that they can be doing is not have knee-jerk reactions, you know, like, you know, to the fuel saving and to anything like that, or the blocking, or anything that we've talked about so far on this show. The most important thing is to be sensible with any implemented changes and do it right. Do it right instead of trying to appease someone, some group, what have you. Yeah, that's the most important thing. All right, we'll move on here to the what's in the windshield. NASCAR rolls into Dover with Cup Xfinity and ARCA, which is an East/National combination this weekend. IndyCar will be in Barber in Alabama this weekend for the Honda Indy Grand Prix of Alabama. I don't know if they still call it that, but I'm going to keep calling it HIGPA. Formula One will take a break week off before returning for the Miami Grand Prix on May 5th, and I think that's mainly everything that's coming up. I think I want to say that there's probably a Supercars race coming up here pretty soon, but I know that they're only racing on like once a month, so whenever it's later in May. Yeah, I figured it was later in May. It's not in the next couple of weeks, so. All right, well, thank you guys so much for listening. We really appreciate all of your support. We really do appreciate it. Remember, you can follow the show at Robin Roller, spelled just as it sounds, RobandRoller. We can be found on Twitter or Instagram. Same goes for our personal accounts. Mine is at rpeters33. That's RPEETERS33. Josh can be found at roller_01. That's ROLLER_01. We really appreciate your support. Again, thank you for all your listening, all of your support. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Don't forget to play along with the Upshift Downshift and the Spotify Question of the Week if you are a Spotify listener. So for Josh Roller, my name is Rob Peters, and this has been the Racing with Rob and Roller podcast. Have a great week, everybody.